Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Barbarians Inside the Gates and Other Controversial Essays by Thomas Sowell. Narrated by Leon Nixon. Introduction. They say that most writers believe that their latest book is their best. So perhaps it is inevitable that I believe this collection of my columns from Forbes magazine and from Creators Syndicate to be better than the three previous collections of such essays. Be that as it may, what all these writings have in common is that they permit me to address a general audience without having to guard against having academics misconstrue every sentence that isn't hedged and footnoted. In other words, common sense can be assumed when writing for the general public, though not when writing for specialists with their own hobby horses and axes to grind. If I say that the sky is blue, the average listener will understand what I mean, but clever sophisticates will point out that the sky is reddish at sunset, black at midnight, and gray on an overcast day. Once freed from the need to be constantly fending off the word twisters, I find that a lot can be said in a brief essay, even on some pretty complex issues. Many laments that the public doesn't understand could more accurately be restated as specialists have not bothered to talk in plain English. The public will not understand that 2 + 2 = 4 if it is expressed in Chinese, but that does not mean that people are incapable of doing arithmetic. If the title of this book suggests that I think we are facing a dire threat to the social fabric of this country, it is because I do. Some of the reasons will become apparent in the essays that follow. However, it may nevertheless be useful to make a distinction between pessimism and despair. Those of us old enough to be privileged to have lived through the great deliverances of the 20th century, the collapse of Jim Crow in the United States and of apartheid in South Africa, the defeat of the Nazis on the battlefields of World War II, and the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, have no right to despair because our society is troubled today. Indeed, we have a duty to fight against the signs of decay and corruption around us. Even if victory seems nowhere on the horizon, think of all the soldiers who gave their young lives, all across this planet, during World War II, when the ultimate outcome was by no means certain and the triumph of unspeakable evil seemed very possible. Think of all those who died lonely and ugly deaths in the gulags of Siberia or in the killing fields of Kampuchea, without even a speck of dignity for themselves or a sign of hope of common decency for others in their societies. Our task is infinitely easier than that. Our danger is nothing worse than unpopularity, and our society, one that has already conquered many obstacles and is capable of overcoming many more. Part 1. The Social Scene. Barbarians inside the gates? Is it hopeless? That is the question that seems implicit and often explicit in discussions of the degeneration of American society and of Western civilization. The signs of this degeneration are all too plain and all too widespread, from declining educational standards to high crime rates, the disintegration of families and record rates of suicide among young people. Able-bodied beggars have become a common sight in American cities from San Francisco to Washington, as well as in such foreign capitals as London and Paris. Senator Pat Moynihan recently pointed out that handgun murders in New York City are now 30 times what they were half a century ago. Racial polarization has also become far more common on elite college campuses than it was 30 years ago, and segregated living arrangements have been created by college administrators who publicly proclaim their devotion to diversity almost hourly. Perhaps worst of all, much of the degeneracy of our times is not merely tolerated but celebrated. The ugly, ignorant, and barbaric lyrics of rap music have been sanctified by benedictions in the columns of the New York Times and by PhDs teaching at Ivy League universities. Multiple murderers are mourned at their executions, and a child molester on the faculty of Stanford University had a medal struck in his honor after he committed suicide when confronted with his crime. Despite a long history of struggle of blacks for better education, It has now become common in ghetto schools across the country for those black youngsters who excel academically to be denounced for acting white and to face social ostracism or even physical violence from their classmates. The dangerous notion that some categories of people are guilty until proven innocent has been creeping into our legal system, along with the sophistry that double jeopardy is not double jeopardy if it is cops who were acquitted when we wanted them convicted. The barbarians are not at the gates. They are inside the gates and have academic tenure, judicial appointments, government grants, and control of the movies, television, and other media. The question of the hour and of the next century is whether all this can be turned around. History shows that degeneracy can be turned around because it has been done in the past. But the real question today is, will we turn it around? Or is what we are doing likely to make matters worse? Clever sophisticates use history to show that there were alarms about crime and violence, and about the decline of the younger generation in the past, suggesting that this shows that there is nothing to worry about. On the contrary, past lamentations were often both correct and a spur to doing something about it. That is what turned things around. In the early 19th century, for example, there were alarming levels of crime and degenerate behavior in American cities and in many European cities as well. What was done about it? Massive efforts were made on many fronts to roll back the tide of barbarism. Programs to instill moral values became widespread, both in the schools and in such newly created organizations as the Young Men's Christian Association. Sunday school attendance tripled between 1821 and 1851. The first real police forces were organized in cities across the United States, and mass movements to get people to stop drinking likewise spread across the country. The per capita consumption of alcohol, which had been going up for decades, fell by 1850 to about one-fifth of what it had been in 1829. Not surprisingly, crime rates began to drop in the middle of the 19th century and continued to fall on into the early years of the 20th century. Studies of crime in London, Stockholm, and Sydney show similar trends during the era of what the intelligentsia today refer to sneeringly as Victorian morality. We have grown so used to crime, violence, and other social degeneracy increasing that it may be hard to realize that improvements in all these things have occurred for long periods of time in the past. The homicide rate in the United States declined from the time national statistics began to be collected in the early 1930s until the 1960s, when the bright ideas of the anointed began to be applied in the criminal justice system, the schools, and elsewhere in American society and in Western civilization in general. Virtually everything that was supposed to make things better made things worse. Worst of all, the assumption and social dogmas of the anointed reigned supreme, from the schools to the colleges and in all the media. What has failed is accepted without question by so-called thinking people, and what worked is disdained as being out of touch with the times. No, the situation is not hopeless, but it is grim, and if nobody does anything to turn it around, it can become hopeless. Lest we forget. Like so many people, I regarded the Memorial Day weekend as a welcome respite from the daily grind and an opportunity for some holiday relaxation. As I was driving toward San Francisco to pursue my hobby of picture taking, I went past a national cemetery where each grave was decorated with a small American flag, all blowing in the breeze, while larger flags flew in the background. The peaceful beauty of the sunny scene could not hide the grim reality of endless rows of gravestones of American soldiers and sailors. "There is the price of freedom," I thought, and I turned into the cemetery. There were not very many people there, perhaps not nearly as many as there should have been. I had no one buried in this cemetery, but I knew that I would not be alive today if it were not for those who were buried beneath the flags and the headstones. At the first place where I stopped to take a picture, there were two gravestones near each other with the same year of birth and the same year of death, a sergeant and a lieutenant, both born in 1921 and both dead in 1944. These young lives that had been snuffed out in the carnage of war were responsible for my still being alive and free. Had Hitler won, I would long ago have been just a wisp of smoke coming out of a chimney in some concentration camp. As I was trying to decide what lenses and films to use, an elderly couple, Asian as it happened, came by with much deeper things on their minds. They were carrying flowers to one of the graves. Here and there, in the sea of gravestones, there were other people, usually in small groups, gathered around a grave of someone dear to them. One lady was sitting by herself on the grass by a grave. Another, much older, was walking toward another grave, leaning heavily on her cane. Coming across a rise was a pretty little girl, maybe 5 or 6 years old. I wondered if anyone had told her how much she owed to these people buried here. I wondered if I would have thought about it myself, if my route had not taken me past this cemetery. In the age of doing your own thing, many seem unwilling to acknowledge how much they owe to others, who never had a chance to do their own thing. In the sobering dignity of a military cemetery, it was hard to imagine how anyone could want to send more young people off into battle, to be cut down on the threshold of life, unless there were some very high stakes for the American people. Those editorial office heroes who are itching to send American troops off to the Balkans or elsewhere need to spend some time in a military cemetery, and especially to notice the terribly young ages of so many buried there. Yet some media people ask, what is the point of being a superpower if we are not going to take on world responsibilities? The point of being a superpower is so that no one will attack you and require the sacrifice of more and more young Americans like those buried in this cemetery. We were attacked at Pearl Harbor because we were sitting ducks who had allowed our military forces to dwindle away until we had a smaller army than Portugal's, and not enough equipment, even for this small force. We are able to go about our daily lives in peace today, only because of our military and naval personnel who are on duty 24 hours a day, many under the sea in nuclear submarines, able to annihilate anyone who launches another Pearl Harbor against us. That is why none has been launched. We have peace not because our politicians are so wise or our diplomats so clever or our journalists so glib. We have peace because of other young lives, willingly disrupted by military duty for the sake of our safety, and willing to join those buried in this cemetery if need be. Once a year is not too often to remember them, and if we ever forget them and the things they stand for, we may not have very many more years as a free people living in peace. Cosmic justice and human reality. Some ideas are so far-fetched that no one who actually thought about them could really believe them. But such ideas may be fiercely defended because they are the basis of other things that people do believe in. Equality is one of the crucial far-fetched ideas of our time. From the soapbox demagogue to the highest court in the land, statistical disparities in outcomes have been treated as virtual proof that somebody was treated unfairly. Apparently, there is no way that they could have performed differently because of the implicit assumption of equality. Yet most people would be hard-pressed to name two individuals who perform equally. What we usually mean when we rate two individuals equally is that they have offsetting advantages. But the same man is not even equal to himself on different days, much less at different periods of his life. Anyone who has watched tennis matches, whether on the local playground or at Wimbledon, has seen player A come and out totally annihilate player B in the first set, and then turn around and lose the match. Not only equality, but superiority is very unreliable. What many people mean by equality is that the races, the sexes, or other large groupings of people have no innate superiority over others. However, innate superiority, inferiority, or equality are about how people are at the moment of conception. But nobody takes an IQ test at the moment of conception. nor do they apply for college or a job then. By the time they do those things, a lot has happened, and it has seldom happened equally. Even before the child is born, the mother's eating, drinking, and smoking affect the formation of the little body inside, including the formation of the brain. The children of teenage mothers have lower IQs even when you take account of all sorts of social variables. There are significant IQ differences between identical twins when one is born substantially heavier than the other. Apparently, whatever has allowed one twin to gain more nutrition during their development leaves the other permanently a little behind mentally, long after they have grown up and their weights are the same. Research has also shown that it makes a big difference whether a small child is constantly talked to and stimulated in various ways, or is just laid down to vegetate somewhere while the mother watches her soap operas or sleeps off a hangover. It is not just a matter of what information is conveyed to the child. Constant interaction, even with low IQ adults, has been shown to improve a child's IQ. It is not what they convey to him, but what they stimulate in him. The physical development of the brain itself is greater in children who have much interaction and many things to think about, however simple those things may be. In the crucial early years, especially, you have to use it or lose it. Painful as it is to think of all the individuals and groups who have lost golden opportunities because of these and numerous other differences beyond their control, the only thing worse than thinking about it is refusing to think about it. A grand pretense, endlessly repeated, does not become a hard fact. The tendency to explain differences by either genetics or discrimination ignores the very large differences that cannot be attributed to either. Numerous visitors to the antebellum South wrote, either privately or publicly, of the great differences between Southern whites and Northern whites. These differences ranged from church services to sex, from child rearing to alcohol consumption, from entrepreneurship to violence. Yet whites in the two sections of the country were of the same race, language, religion, and legal status. Nevertheless, their differences extended across a broad spectrum, including the per capita rate of inventions patented, which was several times as high outside the South. Many 19th century writers, including de Tocqueville, attributed these differences to the concentration of slavery in the South. But the two groups of whites who settled in different regions of the United States came from different regions of Britain, where the same differences existed long before either of them had any slaves. Slavery is not a magic answer to historic questions, either for whites or blacks. Only the prevailing refusal to acknowledge that some cultures are far more effective than others leads us to grasp desperately for such all-purpose explanations of performance differences, including genetics or discrimination. From Marxism to the Market. Recently, a student wrote to ask me a familiar question. How and why had I changed from a young leftist to someone with my present views, which are essentially in favor of free markets and traditional values? In a sense, it was not so much a change in underlying philosophy as in my vision of how human beings operate. Back in the days when I was a Marxist, my primary concern was that ordinary people deserved better and that elites were walking all over them. That is still my primary concern, but the passing decades have taught me that political elites and cultural elites are doing far more damage than the market elites could ever get away with doing. For one thing, the elites of the marketplace have to compete against one another. If General Motors doesn't make the kind of car you want, you can always turn to Ford, Chrysler, Honda, Toyota, and others. But if the Environmental Protection Agency goes off the deep end, there is no alternative agency doing the same thing that you can turn to instead. Even when a particular corporation seems to have a monopoly on its product, as the Aluminum Company of America once did, it must compete with substitute products. If Alcoa had jacked up the price of aluminum to exploit its monopoly position, many things that were made of aluminum would have begun to be made of steel, plastic, and numerous other materials. The net result of market forces was that, half a century after it became a monopoly, Alcoa was charging less for aluminum than it did at the beginning. That was not because the people who ran the company were nice. It was because market competition left them no viable alternative. How you look at the free market depends on how you look at human beings. If everyone were sweetness and light, socialism would be the way to go. Within the traditional family, for example, resources are often lavished on children who don't earn a dime of their own. It is domestic socialism, and even the most hard-bitten capitalists practice it. Maybe someday we will discover creatures in some other galaxy who can operate a whole society that way. But the history of human beings shows that a nation with millions of people cannot operate like one big family. The rhetoric of socialism may be inspiring, but its actual record is dismal. Countries which for centuries exported food have suddenly found themselves forced to import food to stave off starvation after agriculture was socialized. This has happened all over the world, among people of every race. Anyone who saw the contrast between East Berlin and West Berlin back in the days when half the city was controlled by the communists can have no doubts as to which system produces more economic benefits for ordinary people. Even though the people in both parts of the city were of the same race, culture, and history, those living under the communists were painfully poorer, in addition to having less freedom. Much of the same story could be told in Africa, where Ghana relied on socialistic programs and the Ivory Coast relied more on the marketplace, after both countries became independent back in the 1960s. Ghana started off with all the advantages. Its per capita income was double that in the Ivory Coast. But after a couple of decades under different economic systems, the bottom 20% of people in the Ivory Coast had higher incomes than 60% of the people in Ghana. Halfway around the world, it was much the same story in Southeast Asia. Burma once had a higher per capita income than Thailand, until Burma went socialist. Today, Thailand's per capita income is 5 times that of Burma. Economic inefficiency is by no means the worst aspect of socialistic government. Trying to reduce economic inequality by increasing political inequality, which is essentially what Marxism is all about, has cost the lives of millions of innocent people under Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, and others. Politicians cannot be trusted with a monopoly of power over other people's lives. Thousands of years of history have demonstrated this, again and again, and yet again. While my desires for a better life for ordinary people have not changed from the days of my youthful Marxism, experience has taught the bitter lesson that the way to get there is the opposite of what I once thought. Hogwash is happening. Book banning is happening now. This is what the sign said in the midst of a big display in the bookstore window. As it turned out, book banning was not happening. Hogwash was happening. The books in the display were not banned. You can get them in bookstores from sea to shining sea. The government itself buys some of these books. Many of them are circulating in the tens of thousands, and some in the millions. A poster in the display proclaimed this to be Banned Books Week. The kind of shameless propaganda that has become commonplace in false charges of censorship or book banning has apparently now been institutionalized with a week of its own. Someone called the 1930s low, dishonest decade. The 1990s are a serious competitor for that title. False charges of banning or censorship are so common that they are seldom challenged for evidence or even for a definition. To call a book banned because someone decided that it was unsuitable for their particular students or clientele would be to make at least 99% of all books banned. Few individuals or institutions can afford to buy even 1% of the vast number of books that are published annually. They must exercise judgment, and that judgment is necessarily in the negative most of the time. If we are not going to call every book that is not purchased by an institution banned, then how will we define this nebulous but emotional word? Usually, some school or library officials decide to buy a particular book, and then some parents or others object that it is either unsuitable for children or unsuitable in general, for any of a number of reasons. and then some parents or others object that it is either unsuitable for children or unsuitable in general for any of a number of reasons. Then the cry of censorship goes up, even if the book is still being sold openly all over town. If the criterion of censorship is that the objection comes from the general public rather than from people who run schools and libraries, then that is saying that the parents and taxpayers have no right to a say about what is done with their own children or their own money. This is a pretty raw assertion of preemptive superiority, and while many of the self-anointed may think this way, few are bold enough to come right out and say it. Fraudulent words like censorship and banned enable them to avoid having to say it up front. Some of the books shown seem pretty innocuous to me, but there is no more reason why my opinion should prevail than the opinion of someone else, especially when that someone else is a parent or a taxpayer. However, other books in the display were pure propaganda for avant-garde notions that are being foisted onto vulnerable and unsuspecting children in the name of education. Parents have not only a right but a duty to object when their children are being used as objects for other people's ideological crusades, especially when brainwashing replaces education in the public schools. Let the ideologues argue their ideas openly with adults in the marketplace of ideas, not take cowardly advantage of children behind their parents' backs. There's no point arguing about whether this book or that book should or should not have been taken off the shelves. There would not be an issue in the first place if different people did not have different opinions on that point. The question is why some people's opinions are called censorship and other people's opinions are not. No one calls it censorship when the old McGuffey's readers are no longer purchased by the public schools, though they are still available and are actually being used in some private schools. No one calls it censorship if books by Rush Limbaugh are not put into libraries and schools in every town, hamlet, and Middlesex village. It is only when the books approved by the elite intelligentsia are objected to by others that it is called censorship. Apparently, we are not to talk back to our betters. All this is just one more skirmish in the cultural wars of our time. In war, as someone pointed out long ago, truth is the first casualty. Those who are spreading hysteria about book banning and censorship know that they are in a war, but too many of those who thoughtlessly repeat their rhetoric do not. It is not enough to see through fraudulent rhetoric in a particular case if you continue to listen gullibly to those who have used such rhetoric to muddy the waters. There should have been a sign in that bookstore window saying, "Hogwash is happening." That's what really rates 2 exclamation points. And perhaps a National Hogwash Week. Magic Numbers. Recent political controversies over changing the consumer price index might leave the false impression that someone just goofed on this particular statistic, making it an inaccurate measure of inflation. The inaccuracy of the CPI is hard to deny, but this is to some extent inherent not only in this statistic, but in many other statistics on which we rely uncritically. Hospitals and doctors, for example, are sometimes judged by the mortality rates of their patients. Commonsensical as this may sound, it violates one of the most elementary requirements for valid statistics. There is no comparable group of patients with whom these mortality rates can be compared. Some of the best hospitals and some of the best doctors get the toughest cases. If they can save 3/4 of the cases on which others have given up, that is a major achievement, even if it leaves them with a 25% mortality rate. The absence of comparable samples likewise completely undermines a recent study which proved, at least to the media's satisfaction, that spanking does no good and seems to do harm. The study followed children who had been spanked and children who had not. After several months, it turned out that the spanked children's behavior was worse than that of the children who were not spanked. What was lacking was a comparable group of children with given behavior at the outset, so that the effect of spanking could be isolated. Unless parents were spanking their children for no reason, chances are that those who got whacked on the backside were doing something to deserve it. The lack of what statisticians call a control group to compare is just one of the reasons for meaningless and misleading statistics. Failure to define what you are talking about is another. For example, when a man migrates from Italy to Australia and marries a woman who is an Australian citizen, that is counted as an intermarriage in statistics.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?